Welcome back to Highly Respected. I'm your host, Scott Greer, and we have guests returning to the show. I know a lot of you love the solo episodes, but we decided to bring back the guests. And who better to bring back than the one you love, Nightmare Vision? Nightmare, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. How are we doing, Scott?
I'm doing fantastic. Now, it's a funny story how we got Nightmare back on the show. You know, he, as I've talked about this before, he likes to retreat to his woodland hideaway. You know, when I'll try to get him out to come on the show, I will hear no responses back. I'll even do an out call. Nothing heard. But, you know, when I announced that Highly Respected that 2% of our viewers are women, and I have at least 10 million viewers, at least 10 million. So that's around 400,000 women listening to this podcast. And he flew out of the woodland and immediately grabbed the invite. And even when this news was heard, many of Highly Respected's past guests rushed forward to claim their right to come on the show this week. You saw American Renaissance Peter Griffin running in the distance. Lep Sama, unfortunately, was asleep at the time this news was announced. But several other people I don't even want to name were eager to come on the show when they found out that 2% of our listeners are women. So if you are a woman who is highly respected and you really appreciate Nightmare Vision on the show, make sure to let him know in the comments.
Yeah, let me know in the comments. You could get Blep on the next time if you tell him that your audience is now 2% TikTok girls. That'll work.
TikTok cat girls, actually. That would probably get him on. And, you know, American Renaissance Peter Griffin, he was very eager. He was very bummed out that you swooped in and grabbed the invite first. So maybe we'll have him on again. But we've got a lot of very, very serious topics today. And, of course, the biggest news in the country right now is the Capitol Hill siege, which is what everyone continues to talk about. And I gave my initial thoughts on this topic last week. So I want to get Nightmare Vision's initial topic. So what did you think about this whole thing? Where do you see this going? Is this really the worst thing to happen since 9/11?
I mean, it's worse. It was a Nazi insurrection from the dark forces.
They almost took over the government.
The dark forces of the MAGA movement have finally reared their ugly heads, and it's just Nazis as far as the eye can see. And just thank God that our brave Antifa Capitol Hill police guards were there.
Our heroic black police officers. The white police officers were not there. This one black guy stopped them.
It was basically like Normandy in reverse, with the Nazis were storming, and the brave heroic allies were holding them at bay. It was like Saving Private Ryan, but backwards and about Drumpf.
Yeah, and it was all apparently largely black and brown cops, as I've been seeing that there was a tweet the other day from this guy who's a Cheddar host, which is this TV internet streaming service that no one watched. And he was like, the Capitol was built by black slaves to house a mostly white representation. It's always been like that. But it's very funny that the people who defended it were largely black and brown, which the only evidence for this is that one black cop in the video. Or the pitcher, it's the pitcher rather, and he's like telling people to hold back. But in the video, you clearly see him running away from the crowd and then continuing to be like, hey, hold on. And then he continues to run away. So I'm not sure how he prevented democracy from being toppled, but that's the line they're going with. So, I mean, there's a lot to...
No, the real hero, Scott, was that one black guy that went and he said that he was going to get his stimmy. And then they had a picture of him inside, I believe, the Senate chambers. And he quoted him that picture of himself on his own Twitter account saying that I told him I was coming to get it.
I don't think he got it. No, all these idiots were very open. Like one of the, I guess you would call him protagonists of this, of the siege, the guy in the QAnon hoodie, who I'm pretty sure was the one who chased the black police officer, or the black police officer kept fleeing from. And like people were tagging, he's like, can you believe this? And on his own Twitter account, it's like, hey, that's me, with his full name, with his full name, like his photo. And he's like, did you like my hoodie? And it's like, no, great OPSEC going on and committing a federal felony with a lot of this. But, you know, there's a lot to take in from this. But What do you think about the whole media interpretation of this and the political ramifications of it?
I mean, in the short term, I think it's like there's a real distinction between the short term and long term. So let me I think it's significant to point that out, because in the short term, it's probably terrible, but not because not for the reasons that the media is saying and all the hysterical people that have been propagandized are saying. It's terrible because this is like a pretext for the media to gaslight the population, but also to provide basically a pretext for power to exert itself in like an unprecedented way, you know, at least in like the last few decades, right? Like to just exert itself on the population and on, you know, especially it's going to manifest most clearly on social media. But I like in the long term, I don't know how bad any of this is going to be, because I actually don't really, I mean, this, not that I support, you know, I don't support violence. I don't support anything like that, of course, but I don't necessarily think that volatility or the kind of chaos that seems to be coming through the introduction of the Biden administration or like anything, you know, related to that, I don't think that's necessarily going to create like a very predictable future. I think it, like, you know, chaos is kind of unpredictable in and of itself. And I don't think people should be too afraid of that. I mean, they should be afraid in some instances of it, because it's negative, right? No one wants to see their own country kind of on an increasing decline, and then like an economic decline, and then with a more like erratic expression of misery through like, you know, violence and potential mob action, things like that are, yeah, you could be afraid of that. But I just mean afraid in terms of like, it's only going to get worse. There's going to be no silver linings or anything good potentially coming from that. Because again, it's like, it's the nature of an unpredictable situation that you really can't predict all the outcomes. And so that's the, like the long-term, in other words, is like unknown. But that also, the fact that it's unknown, it defeats the kind of overly pessimistic interpretation also. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get your point that we shouldn't automatically go into black pill mode at what's happening right now. No. People are already, it's like, everything is over. Politics no longer matter. We're all going to die. You know, there's like several people who immediately go to black pilling. No matter what happens, like people, that's like all people's like first reaction is automatic black pilling, that everything is over. And but you really don't know what the future holds. And you have to think about this, is that I've been talking to a lot of people who live out, you know, in real America. Apparently I don't live in real America, but who talk to like normal people.
You mean Serbia, and, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In that way. And they, yeah, in Serbia, the insurgent territory, and they talk to random people, just like normal people at their jobs and workplaces and restaurants. And like, these people are really mad at what's happening, especially the fact that, you know, big tech can now censor the president. You know, the president of the United States no longer has a platform to speak from anywhere on the internet, which is a, you know, something that we could have never thought of. And of course, our whole media and corporations and the political infrastructure of the Democratic Party is like, this is a great thing. This is democracy at work, that private corporations can censor our president and effectively topple him from power. And every government elsewhere in the world is like, this is a really bad precedent that you could just overthrow your democratically elected president through corporate power, that you can effectively shut him up and prevent him from speaking to the population. And it's just these few corporate titans who have that control, along with the journalists who are demanding it, that can affect this to anyone. And you could see this from people like Merkel, who's complaining about it. Several Latin American presidents, I believe the Mexican president has complained about it. Even the Russian dissident Alexei Navalny, who the State Department and all these globalists love and the media loves, is like, this is really bad. This is what happens in Russia when they want to shut me down, that they just effectively ban me from speaking on the internet. And they use these spurious pretexts saying like, well, he's inciting violence and he could cause an insurrection, and that's why we have to censor him for the good of democracy. And the reason why they banned Trump was because he merely said he wasn't going to the inauguration, which they didn't want him at the inauguration. It was simply stating a matter of fact. and they're interpreting this as a secret hidden code for his supporters to revolt an inauguration. But he's merely just said, I'm not attending inauguration. And now they're even, you know, corporations are coming down. And if you challenge the election results, if you don't accept them full heartedly and say, this is the freest and fairest election in human history, then you face censorship or termination from your job. Because Cumulus Radio, which is one of the largest providers of conservative talk radio, they told all their guests, which includes Mark Levin, Ben Shapiro, and a few others, that if you question the election anymore, you will be fired. So this is the new normal we're seeing. But there is, people are noticing, and people aren't necessarily accepting it. And that is something to white pill about.
I mean, journalists now are becoming like the inverse of like QAnon supporters, where like they discern like the hidden cryptographic messages hidden within Trump statements.
They've been doing this like the hidden white power symbol of the OK sign. Like, what is he signaling here? And they'll always go into numbers, and it's like pure schizophrenia what they go into. I mean,
remember, this is funny though, Scott, because like journalists did it first. Like, remember, these are the people laughing at QAnon and QAnon supporters for doing exactly what they've been doing for years prior. Like, if you turn the OK hand gesture into like an unironic white power, like neo-Nazi symbol, it's the most ridiculous thing. That's clearly more absurd than like, you know, discerning like a Q pattern in the upholstery in a picture that like Melania Trump took or something like that.
And the QAnon people don't have power. It's like, it's just goofy boomers. Like, you know, of course I don't necessarily endorse people going down the QAnon rabbit hole, but there's always been these weird conspiracy theories, and it's generally just some dude on Twitter who's like, look at this chair pattern that Q sent us. And then this is like a sign for the president. And they don't really have necessarily the power, but a journalist like saying like some random person giving the okay hand sign, that could cost them their job. I mean, there's been several people who've been fired simply for giving the okay hand gesture, which is one of the most common gestures in America prior to Trump. But now it's been turned into the equivalent of a Roman salute, which is just like, showing how crazy we are now.
You have like these like hysterical pieces about how like QAnon represents like the ultimate threat to democracy. It's the ultimate expression of disinformation. And like, then you look at like the next piece by the same like journalist, and it's like, why Walmart is pricing things at $14.88, like, and what does that mean? And like, when are they going to shut down that company forever and fire all the employees?
And that's true. And it really has to be stressed that all these arguments for censorship and the suppression of Trump's base comes on, we're defending democracy. It's like, we must do this to uphold democracy. And it's like, what is the democratic angle that unelected bureaucrats and the most powerful people in this country, in the world, now can just shut down, you know, working class people in, you know, Arkansas from like ever daring to question the election results again? But this is like for the sake of democracy. And it's really, in a way, we're, you know, I've said this on Twitter, is that we are moving more to a Warsaw Pact country. Is that in these countries, they also had sham elections where everyone had to accept them as totally legitimate. There's no question about it. Yes, we elected this person with 96% of the vote. We're going to totally believe this. You can't question the election. Every single person has to bow their head and accept what the state legitimacy and what the state ideology is. Like in current America, like this war is going on. It's like the fact that the powers that be, the system cannot accept anyone not accept like full-heartedly embracing their ideology. Like, you must embrace it. You must celebrate the election we had. You must be happy that Joe Biden is your president, and you cannot be at all disturbed by it. And you must accept Black Lives Matter, and you must stand with Black Lives Matter. Otherwise, that could cost you your job, and maybe we could press federal charges against you for questioning the election results. This is the type of norm that we're having, that you don't really have freedom. We don't really have freedom of speech. The fact of the matter is, Twitter, Facebook, and all these platforms are the public forums of our day. And if you are banned from it, you have no speech. You have no way of expressing yourself. And we're seeing that with the president of the United States, who now has no way of communicating with the American public because he's banned from the internet.
Yeah, I think we should get into, getting into some of the short-term stuff. Like I said, the short-term is bad. The long-term is, who knows? I wouldn't really even worry about it. Or in fact, I'd be optimistic about it, frankly, because I think that 2014 and 2015 had the same kind of feeling. And I think a lot of good came out of that ultimately. But in the short term, everything that you're saying is right. And it's really important to note that this cuts across the thing you just described cuts against the kind of insincere talk of unity that's being sent out by Democrats, Biden, the media. It's so cynical because the way that they've acted, the way that the media and Democrats and Republicans, frankly, have acted since Trump's victory in 2016 has been basically one giant attempt to delegitimize him as a leader. And then after the election, they refuse to admit the incredibly suspicious experience of the election in November. And the kind of, there is nothing conciliatory about the attitude of the media since the election and the times leading up to it. Because remember, Trump himself was, people forget this, but Trump actually was kind of warning people that something like this was going to happen with the coronavirus, the COVID lockdowns going into the voting system was going to they were heading towards problems. But the point I'm trying to make is that the way the media has acted since the election is not how you act when you want quote unquote unity, right? Like what's happened since the election is this attempt to meme the term disinformation into the population, into the lexicon, as hard as they can, to treat anybody who has any questions about what happened as literally a Nazi, to try to unperson anybody who ever dared publicly support Trump over the past 4 or 5 years. It's so disgusting what's going on because you have this kind of insincere unity talk while at the same time, it's not like a concealed operation. It's like an out and proud attempt to marginalize, literally marginalize millions of people in this country and to even go after anyone who has any tangible association with Trump, the president, and eventually Trump, the businessman. I bet it'll, they'll revise history to such a degree that anyone who was ever associated with Trump kind of falls under the same shadow. And so that's what's really going on beyond all this talk about unity. And you hear that all the time now about how we need to come together. And it's how is coming together with you have a military presence at the inauguration and no voters? It's a really creepy police state visage that's being given to people right now. And there's nothing unifying about it. And in fact, the very people calling for unity are, and again, this isn't a hidden thing. They're openly stoking the flames of a civil conflict, not necessarily a civil war. I don't think that, but a definitely accelerated civil conflict. They're responsible for it, while at the same time, they're disingenuously pretending that there's some other obstacle to quote unquote unity besides themselves.
Yeah, and I think we're already seeing that rhetoric emerge. I mean, I believe it was Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post and Nicole Hannah-Jones of the New York Times, who's the famous curator of the 1619 Project. We're both saying we need to deprogram Trump supporters, that we need to re-educate them to accept the current state ideology. And you're going to see this, that they really want, the Democratic Party and its media allies really want to take this opportunity to wage a war against Trump America, ensure that they can never do 2016 again, that their votes are not going to count, and that the Republican Party becomes essentially controlled opposition. Chris, it's loyal opposition, so they're loyal to the Democratic regime. It's really just controlled opposition. They really don't stand up for anything. They just merely care about tax cuts and regulating up for their people. And they're not really doing that right now. None of these Republicans, they're all of Trump supporters right now are being branded as domestic terrorists. Like, domestic terrorists has become this widely abused term. And, you know, both of you and I are millennials, and we grew up during the Bush era where all these liberals complained about how everyone was a terrorist. Now, literally everyone, half this country are terrorists just because they have questions about the election, because they don't necessarily support Black Lives Matter, because they don't necessarily think that the protest of the Capitol was the worst thing to happen since 9/11. And now we have to have this whole new language of branding enemies of the state, enemies of the liberal system as domestic terrorists. And a lot of people pointed this out, that it's moved, the language has moved from white supremacist, which is just a moral category to shame people, to a legal category that they can use to arrest you and, you know, shun you from society in a way that they couldn't necessarily do with a term that's assigned to an ideology. Is that this like thing, like they could just admit, and they want to pass this domestic terrorism law, which a few civil libertarians who exist, like Intercept, has criticized it. Surprisingly, Ilhan Omar has criticized it. Well, for the stupid reason that, well, we don't want to take revenge on these people because of how they treated Black and brown people. And it's like, you guys never suffered anything like this under the Patriot Act, where they're just going to like condemn people who are in, like, I don't know. You can see the bizarre situation where Turning Point USA is declared a domestic terrorist outfit. Some of my listeners may find that hilarious, but that's a terrible standard to happen. And they could easily do that because TPUSA was supporting the initial rally, and they could declare that any group that backed it from the Republican Attorney General's Association is now a domestic terror group. And this is used to go after domestic enemies. Like, the real term is domestic enemies. The state has gone into, is manipulating language and psyoping people into believing that this is a grave threat to our democracy, which democracy apparently doesn't give half the country the ability to have a say over their lives. And how that's just going to be used to suppress it. But we do have this, like, very serious worries that are happening. I mean, this is, once again, in the short term. I think people aren't going to accept it. And I want to say is that the Capitol siege, I think, was very unwise. And of course, the show does not support criminality or illegality. But there's at some point where, you know, people need to show that middle America isn't just going to sit back and just take what they're given. And a lot of people were saying, well, they were manipulated by lies and election fraud. And you can see this by a few people on the right. And it's like, well, a lot of these people are getting dispossessed in their own country. Like, you could say that, like, well, the reason that they use election fraud wasn't a legitimate reason. But there's so many other reasons for them to be mad about politicians, from all of them supporting mass immigration, to all of them supporting Black Lives Matter, to all of them not standing up for their interests, to the inability to do anything about tech censorship, or, you know, how they screwed them over with the COVID stimulus bills. You know, there's so many reasons for them to be mad at politicians who are selling off the country. And you have to wonder, it's like, eventually they're just going to get mad and do something and, like, have these aggressive demonstrations like this. Now, I don't necessarily think it was wise, because there's the massive backlash that's happening almost, of course, dwarfs whatever occurred, but there is a sign that, like, it is still a sign that these red state Americans aren't necessarily going to take what's delivered to them. You know, getting so much shit that, you know, eventually they're going to say, we're not going to take it. But you know, a lot of people continue to call this an insurrection. What do you think about that matter, that they're like, this is the term that has to be used? It's either attempted coup or insurrection.
Well, In a sense, like, you're right about it being unwise. And, like, you know, we should just say that, like, people generally shouldn't be attending rallies where they don't know who's there, who's organizing them. It's generally wise to stay, you know, as anonymous and out of the public eye as you possibly can, especially now. But given that, right, they're really, you know, to kind of give, like, an indirect defense of these people, because I think that's the most important thing, that, like, What needs to happen right now is, like, an indirect defense of the kinds of things that happened and are probably going to happen in the future, in my opinion, right? Because I don't have to necessarily support formally or materially what happened to the Capitol. But yeah, like, the idea that there's this way of avoiding everybody calling you a Nazi terrorist is kind of far-fetched to me. Like, I really don't buy it, right? Because you have to understand what, like, if without context, you don't really understand why it's necessary, because you know, your response to that is like, why would something like that be necessary? You know, but it is necessary because, right, you have to remember that America is an insane and evil, evil country, right? Like, the whole joke of 2016 and Donald Trump was that, and you know, as someone who supported him back then, I was aware of this. Almost everyone that I talked to on like the far right or like the far left, people who kind of got what Trump's appeal was, understood that Trump is kind of like a moderate figure. He's a 90s Democrat, New York liberal. He's not culturally conservative. He's not socially conservative. He's not religious in any meaningful capacity. All his campaign was based on is questioning some of the fundamental tenets of contemporary American politics that are clearly insane and evil as hell. Just like opening the border, mass immigration, never-ending war all over the world, and an economic series of economic policies that are just totally immiserating the country. The joke of Trump's campaign was that questioning those things in America makes you a Nazi. Like, that's not a joke. Like, that's not funny. Like, journalists in America think you're a Nazi terrorist if you think those things are bad. And there's no way to get around that. There's no clever rhetorical angle. There's no activist, like niche activist mechanism whereby you can question the fundamental bipartisan consensus of American politics since the end of the Cold War and not be designated an extremist, or now that, like you said, they're trying to give teeth to these kind of moral terms, a domestic terrorist and a threat. There's just no way around it. That's why someone like Donald Trump was necessary and why it continues to be necessary, because the idea that Donald Trump is responsible for escalating this and accelerating it is ludicrous. This is accelerating because America is an insane and evil place with insane and evil corrupt rulers. Our elite are awful. They are terrible human beings, politically, morally, spiritually, totally terrible human beings. And the idea that this rhetoric somehow reflects on the people that are dissatisfied with the current system is so dishonest that you almost want to laugh if it's not, if it weren't so ubiquitous at the time, right? Like, no one questions, well, actually, the funny part, I was going to say, no one questions Bernie Sanders supporters when they issue these kind of blanket moral condemnations of America as it exists today, right? Like, this is a first world country that can't even provide like basic healthcare to its citizens. But the funny part is that that's not really true, is it? Like, Bernie Sanders supporters were also kind of being castigated by the media as like closet, like white supremacist, potentially maybe Nazis, which should just show that there's no way around this. So when you're being, you know, spoon-fed this propaganda that like, oh, this was a Nazi coup, this was an insurrection, you're buying into nothing other than like the hysterical, intentionally, by the way, the intentional hysterical mental projections of the media class and the politicians that are looking for a pretext to expand their power. But you have to remember that the search for a pretext on power's behalf is never in vain, right? This is very important. The idea that Twitter, in other words, without this thing at the Capitol, for instance, that, oh, Jack Dorsey just simply would never find a pretext to ban Donald Trump's Twitter account if it weren't for these foolish people. Like, how dumb do you have to be to legitimately think that, you know? So this crunch was coming no matter what. There was no way to avoid this. And so given all the caveats of like the condemnatory language, which again, I support, I think people should generally stay away from rallies, especially ones that could potentially be dangerous. People should not expose their information. They should stay as low key as they possibly can while all this is going on. But with that said, it's still, like you said, it's really just a giant game of victim blaming. These people have no power. These people have no power. And that's what makes the additional comparisons by the media of what happened to the Capitol to the BLM rioting and protesting during the summer, even like that, that's what increases the level of absurdity about this, because all you've been getting are these comparisons that are fueled by racial resentment, right? Like people are asked, oh, well, what if they were black? What if these protesters were black? If they were black, presumably the idea is that like, if any black people ever show up at the Capitol, they're just going to be like unceremoniously gunned down.
Yeah, murdered. With like, it's like, you know, like we have evidence. And as I said last week, we've had evidence of, you know, of left-wing protesters storming the Capitol and the police just let them and the media celebrated.
Yeah.
And we and also we have evidence of black protesters storming federal buildings or state buildings throughout the country, you know, burning down police headquarters, attacking the federal courthouse in Portland night after night. And the media supported them and the cops were restrained. Like, even if you look at Portland, you know, these guys are throwing Molotov cocktails and then the police just use standard riot control gear. And they're like, this is fascism that they're trying to stop, these Molotov cocktail throwing anarchists. And that's, you know, this is the evidence. Like if blacks actually did storm, like say that Trump had won and blacks, you know, Black Lives Matter had stormed the Capitol, they've been welcomed with the open arms. Like Chuck Schumer would have probably invited them all into his office to say, this is a brave day for democracy if this had happened. And, you know, the shoe's on the other foot, but they always have to say that, you know, there's some double standard that exists for whites that doesn't exist for others. Well, there is a double standard that the state will come down harder on you.
And there's, there's not even a rationale for comparison, because the stuff that was happening in the wake of George Floyd's death was essentially like a controlled burn by local Democrat machines in order to terrorize the populace. It was like an ordered anarchy. Like, you know, it was like, you know, the classic term is anarcho-tyranny. It was an example of anarcho-tyranny where elements of the underclass with anti-fascist organizers and protesters were basically allowed to do violence to, you know, places of business. And like, you know, people love to point out that like, oh, well, you know, what do you care about a big box store? It's like, I don't have to care about a Target in order to have the mind to distinguish targeting like a store or windows of a bank or something like that from going to the Capitol in the capital city of your country. Like, there's not even a rationale of comparison here. The stuff that was going on in the summer wasn't targeted. It needed reams and reams of journalistic dishonesty to even get the veneer of political integrity to it. What happened at the Capitol was people showing up where their senators and congressmen meet. Like that, that's exactly where you would want to show up.
The temple of our democracy.
Yeah, like, hey, exactly, right?
These stupid arguments, like it's like it was Notre Dame Cathedral was like assaulted by a barbarian horde. That like, it's like nobody thinks these like politicians are great people. Like the public state, like the public approval of Congress has always been abysmal for several years. And there's like even these all these cultural jokes about how like all these politicians need to be thrown out of office, and there's several jokes about mob violence against them. But now we have to like be horrified that we had Chuck Schumer like cowering in his office, and all these people are like, what? Like, yeah. Okay, it's okay if some small business owner has their whole life destroyed, you know, they're assaulted by a mob, we're not supposed to care about that because they have insurance. Well, Congress has insurance too, and they are certainly, everything that happened to them is going to be replaced, and there's not nearly the concern. Like, they will build back better, as Biden says. But all these small businesses in Kenosha and Minneapolis are never coming back, and everything's ruined, and no one gives a shit about them.
Exactly. And think about the implicit moral argument being made. Like, oh, well, you know, burning down sections of your own town. Well, you know, riots are the language of the unheard, and white supremacy is basically a more dangerous disease than, you know, viral plagues. But there is literally no logic whatsoever to, you know, angry, disenfranchised citizens showing up at the Capitol building. That one is just a puzzle. It's like a total mystery. We can't figure out why anybody would decide that they've had enough of Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell and Nancy Pelosi. Meanwhile, some of the people that were condemning what happened at the Capitol, you could probably go through their Twitters and find them talking about how livid they are that they're not going to get $2,000 specifically because of Mitch McConnell. And then they turned around and got angry at the people that actually showed up to his place of work.
And the left has been encouraging people to go to Republicans' houses and like town halls and like aggressively demonstrate against them. I mean, there were several Republicans who had their houses attacked. There was also the gunman, the Bernie Sanders supporter who nearly tried to kill a Republican congressman, which when that happened, that wasn't a sign that like, huh, why is the left encouraging violence? It was like, we need to just come together. And that was due to mostly Republican stupidity in that case. But we had several incidents, you know, even when the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearing, all these guys were like aggressively had aggressive protests outside their house. They'd be harassed by people. But whenever that happened, they're like, well, this is power to the people. This is just the people letting them know they're upset. But you know, when people go through the Capitol and, you know, not necessarily saying we support it, but like, you know, this stuff happens all the time, but it's only a domestic terrorism when the right does it. And this is the language that they're using to, you know, really rally the people into not wanting any dissent. Like, we have to criminalize dissent. And whenever there's like a news story, as you were saying before, whenever there's a news story that upsets the elites or the people in power, we just say it's Russian disinformation, such as the Hunter Biden story, where we had all these intelligence officials come out and lie and say that this is a Russian disinformation operation. And then later it proved, no, this is 100%. The laptop is real. Russian agents have nothing to do with it. But all these people came out and lied about it, saying it's Russian disinformation. And you're going to see the Biden administration, if there's any harmful news stories to it, even if it's reported by the mainstream media, they're going to say this is disinformation. And we already saw how their treatment of the press is going to go with Kamala Harris. People getting irate at Vogue, I think it was Vogue or Vanity Fair, who did this cover shot that she didn't like. It didn't like make her look appealing enough. And this became a major controversy. And this is in the middle of, you know, all the Capitol riots, is that this huge outrage was that Vogue did not publish the picture that Kamala Harris wanted. And there were several journalists who were attacking Vogue and several other activists who were saying that they're doing the dirty work and this is racist and sexist because of just some photo. And you're going to see this time and time again, is that the media has paved the way for, it's easy to criminalize dissent and to shun away criticism just by saying it's disinformation, or you're, if you're protesting against some bill that the Democrats support and the liberal system supports, then you're domestic terrorists, even if you're peacefully protesting. And you can see this, you know, when amnesty comes up, and if there's boomers who are merely just walking around holding signs outside of like a congressman's office, they're going to say this is domestic terrorism. So this is a way that they now have the language to suppress anyone that they, that opposes them.
Yeah, and it's clear. Now, like, I'm sorry, keep going.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, like, it's also this is partly why I'm generally not pessimistic at all, because, you know, the, like, bringing up the Kamala Harris story, it's like the attempt to, you know, reintroduce this kind of incredibly superficial upper middle class, like white woman politics back into the, like, American consciousness, I find it to be like really bad and like pathetic. And I don't know for sure, but like, if you put a gun to my head, I would tell you, like, there's no way this is going to work. Like, you have massive unrest. The lockdowns made everything worse. Things were bad before then too, just even in 2015 and 2016. If they weren't bad, someone like Trump would have never been able to make any headway. So the attempt to kind of re-Obama-ize our politics with this kind of superficial celebrity stuff, which is kind of ironic because, right, like, Trump is always demonized because he's like, he was on a TV show and he's like a reality TV star. And like, people like, they try to like berate him as like the celebrity president. That really wasn't true compared to people like Obama and someone like Kamala Harris, because it's these politicians that are directly relying on a kind of like a media fabricated sense of celebrity to cover up their like actual political goings on and their activities and stuff. And like, this is part of the criticism that you had from even like, you know, like dirtbag leftists and stuff. Like, this was the joke, right? That like, you're going to get, you know, people like Hillary Clinton is going to talk about feminism, sending like a female soldier to like bomb some country in the Middle East or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, the joke, and like, that was part of the humor of it, was that like, it was essentially using your celebrity, using the visage of a celebrity to cover up like incredibly damaging politics underneath. And so I don't think that's really going to work. But the other thing I wanted to talk about was this, like, just getting into this, talking about like the attempt to, I mean, I haven't really seen anyone say this, but like, it's very funny that like, at the same time that you're being deluged with these kind of very silly arguments about how, you know, none of this crushing of dissent violates our free speech and our First Amendment laws, because these are all private companies. Like, Twitter's a private company. Just start your own Twitter if you don't like it. These are, all of this activity is actually being accompanied by the rumblings of, you know, passing laws about domestic terror and stuff. So even on their own, like, these arguments, in my opinion, about dissent and whether its relationship to freedom of speech, I don't buy them. I think they're very weak and terrible arguments by themselves. But even on their own merits, the way the people are actually using them who are defending them, they don't even work, because they're actually being coupled with, like, you know, real government activity attempting to, in the very near future, like, stamp out dissent. So the idea that like, oh, well, this is like this barrier between the public and private, it's like this giant impenetrable wall, and it's never going to be breached. It's absolutely being breached. And the what's going on in the quote unquote private sphere on social media is absolutely now being used as a pretext for public action. In other words, government action, laws, like stuff that actually will, stuff that will uncontroversially muddy the waters of what constitutes free speech according to the First Amendment, like the text, the literal words of the law in the Constitution. That's happening right now. And it's obvious to anyone paying attention that they're looking for as many pretexts to do this as they possibly can. So the relationship there doesn't even stand anymore, according to the inner logic of the people advocating for this, like, you know, it's just a private company, they can do whatever they want.
Exactly. And I want to go back to this point to emphasize that this was not an insurrection or an attempted coup.
No.
This was just like, and also they're trying to say that there was like organization and stuff. It's like, this is one of the most disorganized like affairs that ever happened. It was just a bunch of angry, we use the term boomers, but most of these people are Gen X or are older millennials who were involved in this. They were just like really mad, and they just decided to storm the Capitol. And it was like almost mob behavior rather than like a coordinated effort and organization. And it's very funny that they want to look at the organization behind this when there probably wasn't really any. When there is clearly organization behind a lot of these left-wing Antifa BLM riots over the summer. And there was clearly people traveling across the country with trucks who were handing out pallets of material to help them riot. And no FBI investigation at all. You know, Bill Barr was asleep at the wheel. You know, we're going to ignore this, but we're going to imagine that there's some fantasy organization that inspired these Capitol riots. And there was like no chance of like any toppling of the government. Even if they had like somehow decided to sit in the Capitol, like the government could still easily function. And people just don't have any, like, the American journalist who conveys information to the public has no concept or any knowledge of past coups in other countries or what they look like or what it takes to happen for them. Mainly because a lot of them, you know, the only successful coups that happen is like if the CIA is bankrolling the rebels, as we saw in Ukraine and a couple of other places. But if you want to look at this stuff, it's like, even if they had taken over the Capitol, which didn't seem their plan at all. And like, reporters would ask these people, like, what do you guys plan to do? And like, we don't know. We're just walking around. We'll figure it out as we go along. And they just kind of walked around and didn't do really much of anything.
Yeah, they were looking for like a Deus Ex Machina. Like if they made it into the capital, some sort of miraculous event would have transpired of like world historical significance.
I don't even know. They may have thought that, but then they're like, I don't think we can do anything. And like, even if you take over, and like, even some on the right and the left were like saying like, well, if Trump had like led this, then it could have been a serious attempt. And I was like, no, it wouldn't. Like, first off, there's like no institutional backing for Trump to like pull this off. Like the entire military is opposed to it. The intelligence agencies are opposed to it. Really, like Republicans aren't even really in favor of it. And of course the Democrats are strongly opposed. Like there's no institutional support. All he really had was this mob of people who were there to take over the Capitol. And if you look at past incidents, so, you know, I was thinking of the cop putsch of 1920, which was when the military and conservative politicians managed to take control of Berlin and Weimar, and they thought they had taken over the government. Then they realized like the whole city went on strike against them and they couldn't control it and they had to slip away. And then funnily enough is like all the putsches had to then be recalled by the social democratic government to come suppress the union strikers who had come out to suppress the putsch, which just shows you how crazy the Weimar era politics were. But you've seen these incidents, like even in that case where it was like the military and very powerful political elites like came together to do this, like just, and they took over like all the government institutions and everything like that. They couldn't, like, it's like they just, like, people just said no, and that would have happened even in this case. So, and it wasn't, there wasn't even that plan. Like Trump didn't even go to the Capitol. He didn't even probably realize what was going to happen. He just thought they were just going to yell at the Capitol and maybe this will like force Mike Pence to vote differently, even though Mike Pence had already made his decision. I don't even think there wasn't really this way that we were going to take over the government. And
well, I just say something, Scott? I actually don't think that that's like necessarily a bad thing, because, you know, like it's very popular now to try to, which I think is a good trend overall. It's very popular to try to see the elite presence behind, you know, like seemingly popular uprisings and things like that. Like, you know, people are now like talking about like the CIA a lot, and, you know, whether it's accurate or not, I think a lot of this could be contested, but like, you know, when it came to like the Black Lives Matter protests this summer, and even the ones in 2014 and 2015, a lot of the more shrewd observers were able to realize that, you know, this is a mob action that's being coordinated and directed ultimately by non-mob actors, right? Like, it's just meaning that it's elite. And this has always been a kind of idea that's circulated on, I guess, if you want to call it, among like dissident circles, people who read like Juvenel or, you know, someone like, you know, Mosca, you know, like Curtis Yarvin talks about Mosca a lot, and James Burnham. And this idea that there's basically like nothing really ever happens politically without the backing of an elite. And it's kind of like a critique of populism in the sense that it's a critique that, you know, like, yeah, what happened at the Capitol, like, when people get together, there's just like this magic thing that happens where like organization and orders manifest and you're able to accomplish all these things. And I kind of want to flip that on its head. And like, I think it's like kind of an interesting kind of contrarian take that it's almost better that what happened at the Capitol was not something that's coordinated in this similar manner to like BLM protests. And like you say, things that, you know, things happening like in Ukraine and Eastern European countries and things like that, because, again, America is insane and evil. And so if what happened at the Capitol, like, smacked of being an elite organized action, it probably would have been bad, because American elites are rotten, disgusting human beings to their core. And so the fact that it was like just this like inarticulate kind of pointless meandering, it's totally ripe for mockery and criticism, which I don't necessarily disagree with, but it can't be criticized in a similar way that I'm saying all these other seemingly mass movements can be criticized, in that they're really being astroturfed. And if you want to know what's going on, you have to look behind the scenes, so to speak. If people show up and they're protesting and it's like pointless, and then they try to have this like mock uprising that goes nowhere, and they all go home at the end of the day and they didn't even cover their faces, and most of them might get like apprehended by law enforcement because of their own behavior, I feel like it's a pretty good sign that, like, you know, there isn't like a kind of, you know, mirror version of George Soros twiddling his thumbs or something behind the scenes, which means that, like, you know, you, like I said, you kind of don't want that to be the case, because what American elite do you want right now supporting you? Like, nobody. They're all libtards and awful people. Like, I don't want them there. So it's like, I don't even think it's necessarily bad that this was like a kind of dead end that went nowhere, because it almost like, in a way, in a kind of funny way, it demonstrates like the integrity of what happened.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's like a totally organic. It's like these people were not necessarily, you know, they were just mad and they love the president so much that they decided to storm the Capitol, and but they didn't really have a plan to do it. And even then, it wasn't a fact to take over the government. It was just to get the Congress to vote in the manner that they wanted, which you could say is like intimidation. But I mean, most protests and demonstrations and people blowing up their phone lines is an act of intimidation. And people and protesters, as I said last week, is that protesters have continually barged into Capitol hearings that they weren't supposed to, and staged sit-ins and congressional offices. And that was not treated as domestic terrorism.
Yeah, and this was way less organized than those times. Like, you know, when the Kavanaugh hearings happen, they all have these pre-made signs. They're all being corralled. They all have their chants. This was way less organized than all the other times that people have come into the Capitol for protests.
I don't think the QAnon shaman is a mastermind of political coups. That's just me. But moving on to the political ramifications of this is that the House is voting on impeachment. I believe it went through. So it looks like Trump is getting impeached once again. And this time is that Senate Republicans may vote to remove him from office. Do you think they will?
I want to say no. I think if they did, it would be unprecedented. But with that said, I don't think that the Republicans want him to stay. Like, I think that there's a kind of base motivation to not want to do that. But I don't really know. If they think they can get away with it, they might. Because the reason why they wouldn't is because they don't want to suffer political ramifications for doing it, but they do want to enjoy what they think are the political benefits from a kind of grand ceremonious exiling of Trump from the Republican Party. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like they would love to be able to benefit from a kind of symbolic return to like George Bush and Mitt Romney's Republican Party. Not that it shifted dramatically away from that, but even like rhetorically, even that amount of discrepancy has clearly enraged them, and they really hate Trump. And so I like, if they don't, I think it wouldn't be out of any loyalty to Trump if they don't do it. It's just because they think that there's enough support for Trump the man that they would suffer punishment from it. But I think that if they didn't think that, they probably would and will if they don't, because they really do agree with the Democrats that, like, we don't just want Trump gone. We want Trump to be treated as like Hitler, who attempted to take over the government, and his exodus is like this. It's not just like his term ran out. It's like this willful ejection of this poison from our body politics so we can get back to like wars and more tax cuts and stuff like that. Like, I do think they really do want that.
Yeah, we can all get back to that with Trump gone. And this is a gamble that they're placing. I mean, what makes this different is that Mitch McConnell is reportedly pleased with the prospect of impeachment. Mitch McConnell is making this gamble saying that, you know, we can retain these voters even if we vote for impeachment, that we can get rid of Trump and we'll still retain their voters. And they hope to make that gamble down in Georgia, where they're like, well, you know, Trump is finally gone, but we made so many gains in November that it doesn't really matter. And we'll actually be better off with Trump, but we can still retain what Trump did for us. You know, he got us higher Hispanic support, higher Black turnout, and we can now go back to business as usual, but with the Trump coalition behind us and with all these fired up rural voters. And without Trump at the top of the ticket, they lost in Georgia. They should have won that race, but they did everything possible to depress their turnout among Trump's base. But, you know, that's what doomed them in the election, is that this turnout is that they won back some of these suburbanites, their minority turnout, which they couldn't stop talking about and showing that this is like a new, diverse, inclusive GOP after November. You know, their minority support plummeted as well. And this is all due to Trump, is that the only reason that Blacks and Hispanics voted for them was because of Trump. And the only reason his base turned out was because of Trump. So without Trump, you know, the party can't win in Georgia, was the message they should have learned. But they still haven't learned that message. So with McConnell believes that his legacy depends on this, that he must defend our sacred temple of democracy. And Trump must pay the ultimate price for what he did by inciting this riot, by inciting this insurrection. So they must condemn him and they must attack him. And I don't know if that's, you know, this is really like a suicide mission, is that the Republican voters are pissed. A lot of them may have disapproved of what happened at the Capitol, but if they see their own party remove Trump over this, they're going to be pissed. They're going to be absolute. They're not going to forget this. And the vast majority of Republicans don't blame Trump for the riots. And only, I think it's only like 13 or 15% of Republicans support impeachment against Trump over this. And that number will probably decline as it gets further, is that more people forget about what happened on the last week events. You know, a lot of the shock of it leaves, and I think it's probably going to be less than 10%. And that's going to be pissing off 90% of your supporters to just gain the respect of the Washington Post and Chuck Schumer. And that's the gamble you want to take here, and it's completely stupid. So I don't think McConnell's stupid enough. I think a lot of these reports are him sending signals to Trump to make him do what he wants in his last days of office. And it's a way of threatening him. And yeah, I don't even, if McConnell says he's going to vote for impeachment or vote for removal, I think they would find the 17 or so senators they need to do that. But even with McConnell's support, it's, you know, they're not going to vote to remove him.
What do you think the rationale is, Scott, for not just letting him run out his term?
Say that one more time.
What do you believe the rationale is for not just letting him run out his term, since there's so little time left anyway?
Well, they want him to remove him. They don't want him running again in 2024. They want to remove him from public life. And by doing this, they think that they will finally say, they'll put the final nail in Trump's coffin and he'll be done from politics and Republicans will never have to worry about him again. They think if they let him, first off, they think that they're going to be tainted forever if they don't vote to remove him. This will be they'll be complicit in the assault on democracy. So they're buying into these memes that the elites are shoveling into them. And second, they want to get rid of Trump. And they think that by voting to remove him, that they will do this. So, you know, I understand their points and it's outrageous, but this is like a suicide mission. And McConnell, if he votes to impeach or votes to remove, I mean, that's what the House says. If he does that, then that is an act of suicide for the Republicans. Like, they're going to get destroyed in 2022 because that Trump's base, even though Trump doesn't necessarily have the platforms he did before, he can still communicate with his base, and he's going to tell them all not to show up. And a large majority of, or not a majority, but a large share of them will not turn out for Republicans. And Republicans have no message for these people. And if you ever think about Republican campaigning, they're always warning about doom and gloom and like, we're taking the country back. And it's like, how are you taking the country back by selling out to the Democrats, by removing your champion from office? Like, I don't know what message they would even have in 2022 when they expose themselves as weak and hostile to their own people. So, it'll be interesting to see. I don't think McConnell is stupid enough to vote for removal, but by those two reasons, that he thinks that this is how history will remember him poorly if he doesn't vote for removal, and they think that removal will eliminate Trump from public life, and they will take that gamble. And they have so much contempt for their own voters that they think they'll show up anyway in 2022.
But again, this comes back to what I was trying to say before about like why there is like an optimistic like upside long term to this, which is that, you know, the Republican Party has hated its own voters for decades. And, you know, at the very least now, they won't be able to hide it any longer. And like, you know, that may sound like a small victory, but compared to the way politics were just like 6 years ago, it's something that is a bit unprecedented. That like, you know, supposedly like the strongest, most powerful country in the world, one of its major political parties is now exposed as basically openly working with the opposition party in order to suppress its own voters. Like, it's crazy stuff when you think about it, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I agree it's a small victory, is that, you know, and in any case, what's happening is, as a certain person chanted at one of these rallies, like, destroy the GOP. Well, the GOP seems like it's about to destroy itself. And that does create a new, you know, opportunities in that regard. No matter what happens, is that the GOP cannot return back to the 2014 status quo. It cannot return back to Paul Ryanism. A lot of people think that that is the case, but, you know, these people do have a longer memory than you would imagine. And I think this betrayal is so unfathomable that they would make the GOP establishment pay a price in 2022. They made them pay a price in Georgia. I don't see why they wouldn't do it in the midterms, especially when Trump and his few and the loyalists he has are going to continue to harp on this message that the GOP sold you out and they backstabbed your champion. Don't turn out for them in 2022. And a lot of these people could lose their seats. And there's going to be so many primaries for the people who voted for impeachment. Like, Liz Cheney will get a serious primary challenge in her, well, she's Wyoming's lone congresswoman. So she will be challenged. Kinzinger will be challenged. All these people are going to be challenged in 2022. And they will probably, I think they will, a lot of them will lose their seats. So this is GOP courting a civil war among itself. And it will be interesting to see what happens. Now, one thing we have to consider in mind, and I've always said this on the podcast and in tweets, is that saying Trump is our leader, that we don't really have an alternative figure, and that despite all his failings and errors, that, you know, we have to stick with him. He's the best we got, and, you know, there's not really a replacement central figure for them. Well, now we have a bit of an issue where our leader cannot even communicate with us, and when he leaves the office, like, he is going to be embroiled in so many, like, he's going to be suffering through litigation. He's going to probably lose a lot of his business. He's not going to be able to communicate. As I said, you know, he can't be hammered enough. He's not going to be able to communicate through regular channels. And I think even Fox News will be hesitant to have him on, that he's not going to be able to serve his function as leader as what we thought he would be able to do. Even when he looked like he was going to leave office, that he was going to lose his term, that he would still be relevant. He would still be out there. But now, like, big tech and corporations have ensured or tried their best to ensure that doesn't happen. So we do now actually do need a leader who at least can communicate with us on a regular basis. And if you look at a lot of the people who are in Congress who wanted that role, Josh Hawley's political career is over. A lot of MAGA people like him because they see him, unlike Ted Cruz, as not really condemning the rioters and much more associated with them, are associated with defending Trump and in his election challenge. But Hawley is, like, from what people have told me, is like thinks that he's screwed. He thinks this is a huge error. He's desperate to gain his respectability back, which will never happen. You know, he never intended to be the leader of uncouth Trump nationalism. He always wanted to be respectable, and now he's lost that respectability and that all these elites hate him, and no journalist will ever write a puff piece again about how he's somehow leading the left and right realignment because he occasionally mentions centrist economic positions. You know, that's never going to happen again, and he doesn't really have the charisma or stature to lead a popular, you know, movement like Trump did. You know, he doesn't have the populist touch. Ted Cruz, of course, is like going full on condemning them as domestic terrorists and is trying to move as way possible. So he can't serve this function. So it's not really any political figures. And Ron DeSantis can't really serve that function. He's a governor. He actually has to focus on Florida. And fortunately for him, for his chances in 2024, he has not been at all tainted or either way by either being anti-Trump or pro-Trump by what happened last week. So that could probably help him in 2024. But he can't really serve as the role as this nationalist mouthpiece. So the person who is likely to emerge from this as the new central figure, and he's not perfect either, is probably Tucker Carlson. And a lot of people are going to groan. They're going to think about like, oh, Tucker betrayed us during the election challenge. He didn't show us support. And yeah, you know, some of his shows that he'd done since the election were pretty cringe. And a lot of his, you know, there is some magic to Tucker that has been lost in recent times, but he can regain it. There is nobody who is going to articulate our ideas and our message on a regular basis besides Tucker on his nightly show. Now, he also faces a similar problem to Trump. He may get deplatformed as well. So we could be like, well, he's our new leader. And then 6 months from now, there's some stupid racism controversy that's waged against Tucker. And Fox News finally decides to buckle and get rid of him. And then you could see big tech once again, barring him from YouTube, barring him from Twitter. And the same thing could happen to him. But for right now, the only person who is going to be the standard bearer for America First on a stage that is equivalent to the president or who has this national mainstream platform is Tucker Carlson. And that's who the leader is. That's who necessarily his leader is. And now I've poured some cold water on before on this idea that Tucker would be this incredible presidential candidate. And I've even, and for most recent weeks, I've doubted that he would even run because his main person, Josh Hawley, looked poised to run in 2024. And there was going to be several other candidates that were going to court Tucker's support and share Tucker's ideas, that there was not going to be a point for him to running. But a lot of these people are being eliminated from consideration right now. And depending on what happens, like, I think it's much more likely now, as long as Tucker keeps his show up until the beginning, up until like sometime in 2023, I think he will stand a strong chance of running for president and be a serious contender. And that will probably be the candidate we're running around. I don't think, I've said this before, I thought Trump would be very likely to run. I don't think Trump can't run. Like, unless Twitter and YouTube and Facebook allow him to have his accounts back, which is doubtful, he can't run. And I don't think, and he's also, his finances are going to be so hurt by what happens after he leaves president that he's just not going to have the ability to run. And that's a very unfortunate fact. That
can I, Scott, can I be either. The cold water? Can I be the cold water Scott Greer to your optimism about this?
Sure.
Okay. Like, my cold water take is that this was like a, it's funny, like people said, like, you know, that Trump should cross the Rubicon, all that other stuff. But the truth is that I think that the corporate America probably crossed the Rubicon right now. And I don't think, like, if the issue is ever going to be, well, this, you know, so-and-so would work as long as they aren't going to be deplatformed. I think that what just happened is like the signal that you can't count on that anymore. Like, they're going to be deplatformed. Like, Tucker is going to be deplatformed, and whoever else, it, like, not because of anything particular to Tucker. It's just that, like, right now, I think that the entire move is toward a kind of preemptive deplatforming and a kind of creating the moral environment, the pretext and the justification for, like, further clamping down to create such a suppressive atmosphere that, like, the question won't be in the near future, like, can so-and-so get around being deplatformed? Like, I think it's just gonna happen. Like, so, you know, I think that's the most
to not be black right nightmare. You're all before is like, oh, you know, long term this would be good, and now you're
because
like, oh,
I think
everyone's
that, okay.
gonna be shut down. We're going to the prison camps. Okay.
Well, no. Here's the thing,
none
right?
Of,
like,
none of highly respected female viewers will be at the prison camps. It's gonna be terrible.
It's just all males. Okay. It's just like this is. I think that kind of environment is itself going to create like a level of unpredictability or like volatility that may be beneficial in some way. But yes, if it sounds blackpilling, okay, I'll take it. I don't know what way it's going to be beneficial. I just feel like it will inevitably be in some way. But I don't think like the usual predictable routes of the past 4 years are going to continue to work, because I mean, they just banned the president from the internet, essentially. Like, yeah, I feel like it needs, not to, you know, I don't want to sound depressing, but I think that does need to be appreciated in its gravity. I'm not going to treat it as an irrelevancy, and I'm not going to say it's the end, but I do want to say that it's probably going to be a substantial change to how things are done. And I do think that in the interim, it's going to increase the level of like chaos and potential unrest, especially from his supporters. But again, it could even be from the other side. You never know. Like, if they need to gin up another, you know, George Floyd hoax type thing, they can do that on a dime. And we don't really know what will emerge from that. Like, you know, people kind of forget this, but Black Lives Matter predated Trump. Like, it sounds so weird to say that because it was so recent, but Black Lives Matter existed before Donald Trump did. And Barack Obama presents himself as this like incredibly anodyne figure who just gives a boring speech in his controversial tan suit and then like, you know, goes windsurfing and disappears into the background. But the truth is that his second term was incredibly controversial, and he oversaw like an incredible heightening of racial tension. You know, things that like Black Lives Matter, like what happened in Ferguson, and a lot of like the optics of it was very emblematic of the kind of decline that people were feeling under his administration. And Donald Trump came out of that. And I think that my point is that I think that the government and the media and corporate America are basically trying to like cram the genie back into the bottle, so to speak. And all that's going to do is kind of lay that unpredictable, chaotic groundwork for something new and potentially worse, quote unquote, than Trump. So it's not that, yeah, like I don't have a specific, I don't know exactly what's that's going to look like, but I do know that like a country of like 300 million people where you're increasing lockdowns and, you know, economically crushing, you know, small businesses, and you're demonizing like millions and millions of people who support like a mainstream political party and a president who won a free and fair election twice, I'd argue, right? Like, you're kind of building pressure, you know? And so that pressure is going to have to manifest itself in some way, I believe. So I don't, yeah, like, unfortunately, I can't give you like a solid prediction of like, I wouldn't want to do that. I feel like that's reckless. But I do have a kind of faith that like, in the kind of environment where lots of bad things can happen, lots of good things can happen. And I think that like we ought to embrace that, because I think that there is like a huge overstepping that's going on right now. You know what I mean? Like, I think that this kind of like social media crunch and other things like it are huge in a way for like accelerating the kind of feeling of decline that's going on in the country. And I don't know what people are going to do with it, but I do know that they're going to feel it. And like, you know, so I think that as of now, the most important thing to do is kind of appreciate the gravity of what's going on right now. And if I can, I just want to touch on one other issue, Scott, quickly, since I've been seeing it a lot relating to this kind of tech censorship. And, you know, you kind of, you know, not to retread it, but you see it all the time, this kind of like idea that, well, you know, these are private companies and they should be allowed to do whatever they want. This doesn't violate the First Amendment, right? And of course, aside from the idea that like free speech, the idea of free speech isn't necessarily equivalent to the First Amendment of the Constitution, right? So in other words, something cannot technically violate the First Amendment, but can still violate the spirit of a culture of free speech, which of course all of this does. And as an aside, that argument is kind of pointless anyway, because we know that Silicon Valley is basically in like a symbiotic relationship with the government. And so none of these things are kind of purely market-driven or market-created entities in the first place. I just want to say like that I've been seeing this a lot, and especially, you know, it comes from the same insufferable conservatives that are kind of losing their audience by the day. But I've, you know, you also see this amongst liberals and even self-styled leftists who just have totally betrayed themselves and eliminated themselves as any type of visible force. Like, there is no such thing as leftism anymore. It's just liberals. You know what I mean? Just supporting all this stuff. But I think it's important for people listening to understand, like, that you're being given these libertarian arguments about free speech, and the Republican Party has been doing this for decades, giving you this libertarian rhetoric to justify what's going on. And this has had like a really toxic influence on our politics for like two reasons. And the first is that libertarianism has no power in this country. There is no popular support for libertarianism the way it's popularly portrayed. There's not even a real audience for it outside of Washington, D.C. And that's crucial to understand, because when you're being told, when you're being given these libertarian justifications for massive expansions of power, like corporate power, what you have to understand, what people listening have to understand, is that libertarians never accomplish anything ever. Their rhetoric is pointless. Their beliefs are meaningless. It never goes anywhere. When Charlie Kirk goes out for Turning Points USA and gives this whole spiel about, you know, everything is about capitalism versus socialism and libertarianism is the answer to everything, you have to realize that, like, he's not even getting an audience. And I believe recently he was kind of chided for that by some of his donors or something like that. Like, Charlie Kirk got in trouble, basically, because Turning Point hasn't turned out anybody, right? All he does, and all libertarianism does in America, the only purpose it has ever served is to run interference for the expansion of power and to apologize for the status quo. No laws ever get retracted. They never get unwritten, and no red tape ever gets cut in this country, right? The only thing libertarians do is go to the people who are most upset by it and most immediately affected by it and tell them that they have to take it. These people are complete stooges for state power, which is ironic. And it may be hard to understand because they champion themselves as opposed to everything the state does. But the practical function of libertarianism in America is to serve as the vanguard of the expansion of state power at all costs, because the status quo never changes except in one direction. And when you complain about it, libertarians only show up then to tell you that you have no right to complain. And that's what they're doing now over this censorship. And it doesn't matter whether someone is a dyed-in-the-wool libertarian. Even liberals are offering, like, technically libertarian justifications for, like, Trump being kicked off Twitter and massive bannings and suppression going on social media. And when you stop and recognize, like, this seems a bit cynical, that's because it is. And that's because that's the only purpose libertarianism has in this country. It's a cynical tool that people use to try to shut up their opponents when they don't like an expansion of power that negatively affects them. And the sickest joke of this, I have to say this real quick, just from being on Twitter a lot, is that even the kind of meme communism that you see on Twitter is, I mean, this is kind of a sad thing to say, but they're being manipulated by, like, effete libertarian DC rhetoric and wonks who have no popular support. Because when you style yourself as, like, oh, well, you know what? I'm going to become a communist. I'm going to become a socialist, right? All that's saying is that you're buying into this ridiculous idea that America is this laissez-faire, libertarian, free market society, and that you're standing against it. And that's all I see now on Twitter for, like, months and months now. Capitalism this and capitalism that, and capitalism is the source of all our problems. In a way, just like conservatives and Republicans have been manipulated by this libertarian interference running, being paid for by the donor class and elites in America, the left in a lot of ways is also a foil, or rather they operate as a function of libertarianism. Because if you think that America is a capitalist country purely, and it needs socialism in order to fix itself, or communism, it's like you haven't been paying attention to the development of American political economy for, like, the past hundred years. Like, we have not had a libertarian society, economy, or state in anyone's lifetime who is alive right now. It's the most absurd thing. So even they are being conditioned by this rhetoric. And the only difference is that they're signaling against it in like this comical way. But in, you know, they're still being controlled by it in that they're not really responding to the problems on the ground now, and even to the issues of class that are going on in America now, which is why so many of them are kind of caught up in this contradiction of having to hate Trump voters, because they, Trump voters, in a lot of ways do represent the economics of what they're trying to do, but these people culturally, religiously, racially represent the opposite of everything they stand for. And so everyone's being caught out having to basically respond to libertarianism. And in that, they're making this mistake that like America is libertarian. It's not. It's not. It's just a ridiculous thing to even consider or entertain for a moment. What's happening is you're being given interference. And that's what the Republicans have been doing for decades. That's what even Mitch McConnell does. We know Mitch McConnell's not a libertarian. He doesn't have a libertarian bone in his body. He doesn't care about any of that stuff. Nobody in power cares about any of that stuff. So I just want to say this because people need to know like how useless libertarianism is as a popular front for anything, but how useful it is as a kind of ideological shield for the kind of grab bag of state and corporate power that's been going on in this country for decades. And so that's what's going on when you're being told that like, oh, this censorship doesn't, you know, it doesn't violate the First Amendment. Twitter's just a private company. They can do whatever they want. Like, you know, you have to really appreciate the irony of like people using the arguments of like quote unquote libertarianism, which is supposed to be against the expansions of power, directly to apologize for like the unprecedented expansion of corporate power, and with this talk of domestic terrorism, eventually direct state power. People really need to be aware of what's going on when they hear this stuff.
Exactly. A lot to take in. I don't want any of my listeners to ever say I interrupt our guests from going on Greer-esque monologues ever again after that.
That was beautiful.
I agree with a lot of what you said, and a couple of news broke while you're talking is that McConnell is not going to agree to an impeachment trial before Biden's inauguration. So this will likely take place during Biden's term. As a political calculation, McConnell probably thinks that it will be more politically palatable to the Republican base if they convict Trump after he leaves office. So we'll keep an eye on that. But I generally, going back to one of your original points, is that I agree with that it's so chaotic right now, and what we predict will happen, like somebody like Ron DeSantis or Tucker Carlson emerging and as the winner in 2024. This is going to be a very chaotic 4 years. We have no earthly idea what's going to happen, but there is some things we can assume. And I don't think necessarily what the Trump momentum is going to disappear next month, which some people really believe is going to happen. This will continue to carry on and new opportunities will arise. But I'm going to move on to a few final quick topics before we sign off. Which we had so many news going on besides the Capitol riots is that other things got lost in the mix. Fortunately, highly respected is paying attention to these other news. One news item that really caught my eye was Black South Carolina Rep. James Clyburn, who is the third highest ranking Democrat in the House. He is the House Majority Whip, wants to make the Black National Anthem our national hymn. It wouldn't necessarily replace the national anthem, but join alongside it. It would likely be played at all sporting events alongside the Star Spangled Banner, which a lot of the sporting leagues are already doing. The NFL does that, did that in its first week, and I think it carried it on after the first week. So do you think Lift Every Voice and Sing will one day replace the Star Spangled Banner?
I support that. as a staunch Black nationalist of highly respected, I support wait, what's the song again?
Lift Every Voice and Sing. How do you not know this? Everyone knows it. What are you talking about?
I'm sorry.
It may be Walk a Flock of Flames, No Hands. That might be the new one. We'll have to see what they stick to for the Black National Anthem going forward. But yes, Lift Every Voice and Sing is right now their pick for the anthem.
Oh, wow. What if they make a new one? Could they do that? Could they just like
come up with a brand new jam? Like, we got everybody coming.
They can get celebrities to sing it.
Yeah, they They could definitely do this. It is like so cringe, but it's like expected that they would push this because like our new religion is black worship. I mean, we saw this in the George Floyd riots when all these whites would just bend the knee and they think that like black people have a certain magical ability. There's this viral video going around of this white awful, this awful mom, for those who should know, but awful stands for affluent white female liberal. She made her sons bow down and say, all hail black women. And she's like, black women saved our democracy. I'm making my sons bow before them and hail them. And black people actually believe that black girl magic, which is, I don't know what magic they have, but apparently they're very magical creatures and we have to worship them. And so this is like our new state religion, is that we all gather around to worship blacks. We're going to have a second holiday dedicated towards blacks when Biden becomes president. Juneteenth is definitely going to become a federal holiday. And the only figures in American history we're going to see is our true founding fathers are black. And the only ones we're going to be able to admire and respect are going to be black. And the only statues we're going to be allowed to be created. I mean, some other non-whites will, of course, get a few statues and monuments to themselves. But it's going to be all about how blacks built America. I mean, that was the point of the 1619 Project, saying that the real founders of this country are blacks, that whites are the villains, and we only have a democracy thanks to blacks. And they also, and even the new meme is that they freed themselves during the Civil War. It's somehow, you know, the over 600,000 whites who died in the Civil War had nothing to do with their freedom. It was all blacks.
It's because they tricked the guard into dropping the key. They tricked the guard into dropping the key, like in the movies.
Yeah, and the Civil War had nothing to do with what happened. Actually, blacks were the entirety of the Union Army. It will probably be another historical meme we have to accept in the future. So, I actually do, and the black pilling moment, I could see this just replacing the Star Spangled Banner. I mean, they'll say Francis Scott Key was a slave owner, and there's racist themes in it, and it's too inclusive of, it's too representative of white America, and we need to really represent our true America, which is in black. So I could very well see Lift Every Voice and Sing becoming our new national anthem.
I'll just say real quick that I actually agree that black women have a superpower, because if you're on the last train car and they're on the first train car, you can still hear them, which is like, you know,
they also have wisdom. They also have a lot of wisdom. If you ever go see a horror movie in a theater and they're there, they're advising the characters to not go into that room or to not go down in that basement. So they have a lot of foresight that characters in horror movies do not have. And they really want to let the public know. They're in some ways are Cassandras. They're an entire people full of prophets.
They're also really good at Twitter.
They're also very good at Twitter.
They're really good at Twitter.
Black people do your thing is, of course, the calling sign of awfuls and Middle Easterners and Arabs to cancel white people who do something offensive on TikTok. But speaking of black girl magic, is that Biden's pick to lead the DOJ's civil rights division literally believes in black girl magic. Kristen Clark believes in black superiority. She wrote an op-ed at Harvard, and this is like in 1994, that stated, melanin endows blacks with greater mental, physical, and spiritual abilities, something which cannot be measured based on Eurocentric standards. She also emphatically stated that there are biological differences between blacks and whites, and those account for our cultural differences. Do you think this will stop her confirmation?
No, and I support Hotep occupied government. Yeah, I don't think that'll stop it at all. Like, I think that she'll just look at them like, what? They'll be like, okay, you can go.
Fox will write an article saying that black girl magic is real. There will be a white congresswoman, Democrat, who will say, or it goes to the Senate. There will be a white Democratic senator who says, I agree with what she said, that's true. Like, the black women have greater mental, spiritual, and physical capabilities than whites. And we'll all have to nod our heads, and Republicans are not going to know what the hell to do. They're going to focus, and this came from a Tucker Carlson report, and the one thing that was bad that they really claimed is that she invited some black guy who said some anti-Semitic things to Harvard. This will be the thing they focus on. They will not focus on the fact that she believes melanin makes black people superior to white people. They're not going to do that. We're once again going to hear about how she's an anti-Semite. It's the same with the Nick Cannon scandal that happened earlier this year, where he condemned white people as animals and vicious beasts. And all they could care about was his few brief anti-Semitic remarks, and they ignored the anti-white comments. And we're probably going to see this with Kristen Clark. The one thing with her meeting with hosting a guy who's accused of anti-Semitism may do her in, but there's been so many people who've like had interactions with Louis Farrakhan and figures like that, that like, I don't even think it's going to matter. And
white conservatives need the anti-Semitism accusation, because that's like the only cudgel they have to attack black racists for their like their intense racial hatred. They have, so like you have some like white evangelical Southerner just like screaming at the top of his lungs at some black appointee about how like she hates the children of Israel. And she's like an anti-Semite, even though she has like reams of like just pure like, you know, the inverse of like Klan writings about whites, and he doesn't even care. It's he needs the anti-Semitism in order to even level an accusation.
Yeah, it's the same with like Keith Ellison. I mean, Keith Ellison argued for a black ethnostate, and like that.
I support that. No, he's right. He's absolutely right.
And he argued for that, and instead all they talk about is his like few like vaguely anti-Israel comments, and that's what really matters. So Kristen Clark, her confirmation may be stalled depending on what other associations they find to noted anti-Semites, but
it's going to be good.
Making black superior will likely not.
Nope. No one's going to see this coming, Scott. But when the history books are written, you know, like Steve Saylor and Jared Taylor, like they're not going to get accused of being like believing in race and that makes them evil because they believe in race. No, they're going to be demonized for worshiping the wrong one.
Yeah,
like you know, like you're gonna the main heretics
against black girl magic. We know,
yeah,
black
the girl magic is real. The mainstream take on Steve Saylor like 40 years from now is like, no, like he was right, but like for the wrong group. like he has some good ideas, but you know, he just he flipped, like someone switched the papers when he was out of the office for which race had all the great abilities and which one didn't. That's going to be the take.
Hopefully Kristen Clark leads that commission. But, you know, that's all the topics up until we have our wonderful patron question we have today. As a reminder, you too can get the power to ask questions if you sign up for the patron option at Highly Respected's Patreon. This one comes from Rodney. He asks, Scott, do you sit or stand while you record your podcast? This is a very in-depth question. I wouldn't say I float, but I unfortunately, for all the people who are standing desk enthusiasts, I actually sit while recording. So this, I may lose a lot of my followers over this comment, but yeah, I have to say I sit. If I stand, if I'm going to like start pacing, so that's a
pacing is Lindy. Men pace when they talk.
So. Yeah, no, I don't. Unfortunately, I don't have a standing desk. I can probably try it later on, depending on the thing. But no, for right now, sit while record. How about you, Nightmare?
I fly.
That's true. You're actually perched on your tree branch. So, yeah. You know, that gives it. And that's Lindy, because that's where owls belong. Humans aren't supposed to sit down all the time, but owls are supposed to stay perched on their tree branch. So that exactly. Is pretty good. And also, I want to remind viewers that I think I may have misspoke. I said earlier in the podcast that I had at least 10 million viewers. Actually, it's at least 20 million. I meant 20 million. So that makes sense now with like 2% of our listeners, you know, being women, and that amounting to 400,000. So just want to keep that in mind. I made a huge error earlier before. So I want to just correct the record on that. But that's all the time we have. So Nightmare.
Wait, you have 6 million listeners? Wait, hold on. That math doesn't add up. Divided by, hold on. All right. No, it's great to be here.
Yeah. So tell the good listeners where to follow you.
You could follow me on Twitter at God Close My Eyes, and be sure to do that.
All right. Will do. So thanks for coming on again, Nightmare Vision. We can't wait to have you on again. We'll figure out a new strategy to coax you out of your woodland retreat. And maybe, or maybe American Renaissance Peter Griffin may take your invite. We'll have to see. But thanks we'll again see. For coming on.
All right. Great being here.
And until next time, stay respected.